I'm Johnny B. Good, the host of the podcast Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon. This podcast dives deep into the story of Ray Trapani and his company, CentraTech. I'll explore how 320-somethings built a company out of lies, deceit, and greed.
I've been saying since a very young age that I was going to be a millionaire. If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
Listen to Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Every family has an origin story, one passed down through the generations. Mine happens to be a mystery involving my great-great-grandmother left behind in Sicily. I'm Joe Piazza, and my new podcast will transport you to the gorgeous island of Sicily as I trace my roots back through a whodunit for the ages. Listen to The Sicilian Inheritance on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
A rested child is a happy child. Sleep Tight Stories is a weekly podcast that brings comfort and joy to families worldwide with calming bedtime stories. The stories are relevant to children and spark wonder without overstimulation, so they can fall asleep and stay asleep. Listen to Sleep Tight Stories on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. For a bedtime routine you'll miss when they're grown, Sleep Tight Stories.
Welcome to Invention, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, welcome to Invention. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick.
And today we're going to be talking about barbed wire, which for me, it's interesting to just think about how varied our thoughts can be, just sort of basic word association with barbed wire. Because when I just instantly think of the word without a lot of prepping, you know, I think of barbed wire barriers. Often, I think about barbed wire that is like in the woods. Wrapped around old trees, and the tree is grown around the barbed wire in this kind of grotesque way, but also the tree is kind of conquering the barbed wire. So I think of that. I of course think of metal fences, the tops of metal fences, particularly to keep people out of, say, industrial areas. You see that a lot in the urban environment. And then of course I think about its use in, say, Hellraiser horror films, you know, Event Horizon, or, of course, the violent stunts that you see perpetrated sometimes in professional wrestling.
I definitely assumed there was a pro wrestling angle that led you to this topic.
Yeah. Well, no, I wouldn't say that led me to the topic. I'm not sure what exactly. Yeah, I can't remember what made me think this would be a good one to look into. Mm-hmm. Part of it could be just the fact that there is barbed wire everywhere. Mm-hmm. We tend to not see it even as we see it. And, I mean, part of that is just the nature of, say, a barbed wire fence or a cyclone fencing that's topped with barbed wire is that, of course, you can see through it. You can see what's on the other side. To a certain extent, it is almost invisible. But yet it is there, and it is, if you've stopped to really think about it, it's quite an oppressive presence to have in the world around you.
It's peak hostile architecture.
Yeah. Because, you know, just to go a little deeper in terms of associating barbed wire with what it's been used for. I mean, we have to realize that it's been used to divide up the natural world and enforce artificial barriers to both wildlife and humans. It's been used to enforce contested borders. It was used to create the physical barriers of Nazi prisoner of war camps and, most infamously of all, the fences of concentration and death camps during the Holocaust. It's used to enclose human prisoners. And in all of its uses against humans and with human populations, I mean, it carries with it the threat of ripped and torn flesh.
Mm-hmm. It doesn't just prevent you from crossing, it threatens you.
Yeah.
I mean, it says not just like, I'm going to make it hard for you to get past this point, but it says you will get injured if you try to get past this point.
It will be difficult and or unpleasant. So you'd better stay on your side of the fence, your side of the barbed wire. Now, all that is, you know, kind of dark and grotesque and oppressive and so forth. But the entire episode is not necessarily going to be as grim. Barbed wire has a pretty fascinating history in the United States and in Europe, and we'll get into that even as we discuss its uses and also some of the times and places where people tried to make it a little more a little tamer, I guess. Mm-hmm. But generally, barbed wire is still going to be barbed wire no matter how you twist it. So as usual, let's first talk about what came before barbed wire.
Okay. I figured this is a good place to call out one of the main sources that we're going to be referring to in this episode, which was a good chapter on the history of barbed wire in a book called The Devil's Rope, A Cultural History of Barbed Wire by Alan Krell, who is an associate professor at the School of Art History and Art Education at the University of New South Wales. And so a lot of this book is actually more in the kind of art history realm. It's talking mm-hmm. about symbolism and stuff. But he
works Jesus of Nazareth into the first chapter.
Well, it's interesting. When you look at like the early days of barbed wire, what was the closest precedent you might find in the imagery around you for this twisted, thorny strand of material? It was probably going to be like the crown of thorns that you would see on Jesus's head in mm-hmm. medieval artwork.
Yeah, yeah. So it really is a natural transformation to go from a crown of thorns to potentially, you know, a crown of barbed wire, which, as the author points out, like you see this kind of imagery thrown around even in the early literature about barbed wire. So for the most part, we're talking about inventions and innovations of the 19th century here. Prior to the 19th century, humans obviously had a robust collection of barrier technologies up their sleeves. Wall and fence technologies extend back to ancient times. And we mentioned a lot of this in our previous invention episode on walls. Among the earliest known defensive walls are the ancient walls of Mesopotamia, specifically those constructed in the 21st century BCE by the Sumerian rulers Shulgi and Shusin.
And of course, this would refer to the earliest territorial border wall we can find evidence of. Now, if you're just talking about defensive walls for castles or towns or buildings, that's much, much older. That's going to go back many centuries.
Yeah. And as for fencing itself, and it is in the construction of fences as opposed to full-on walls, the ancient history here is also murky and impossible to nail down. I was looking at Old Fences in Archaeology by Arnie Inarison, presented at the 84th annual meeting of the Society for American Archaeology, and the author points out that fences are just a prominent feature of most cultural landscapes and that they frequently play into land division and on-farm grazing management.
Mm-hmm.
So it stands to reason that we can roughly, I guess, think of fencing as a product of the agricultural revolution. But on the other hand, nomadic herdsmen seemingly made use of animal pens and essentially fences as well in their temporary settlements. So it really goes back far in human history. There is no individual person or culture we can point to and say, hey, they came up with fencing.
Yeah, and I think when you go back farther into history, most fencing is going to be for the control of animals rather mm-hmm. than for the control of humans.
Yeah, you're talking about just mild barriers to make managing your various domesticated animals a little easier. So let's fast forward a bit, all the way to 19th century CE America and Europe, but specifically America, because this is where we encounter the European settlers' dream of manifest destiny, the idea that here is the American frontier spread before us, and it is ours for the taking by divine right. And part of this whole vision, of course, is the idea that you just have these vast empty stretches of land, right? Of course, in reality, these lands were far from unoccupied. There were, of course, animals living there. As with any of the continents, you have large megafauna that required large areas to roam around in. But then you also had native peoples that had lived here for at least 15,000 years. But in spite of all that, it was decided that everybody was going to get a chance to have a piece of this unclaimed frontier. So as Eleanor Cummins outlined in A Brief History of Barbed Wire for Popular Science, Abraham Lincoln's Homestead Act of 1862 opened it up for any American to claim 160 acres of public land per citizen. All you had to do was go out there, claim it, and of course, what are you going to do? Maybe throw a fence around it. And so the land was divided. The land was worked and transformed. And if you're looking to keep animals on your property and or keep other animals off of it, it does pay to build some fences. But while the American frontier wasn't all empty plains and, you know, barren, the Great American Desert and so forth, there were still plenty of areas where there was a lack of trees and wood, and therefore it made traditional fences a difficult proposition. And it also took it took longer than was comfortable in many cases to grow, say, hedgerows to serve as natural barriers.
Mm-hmm.
And so settlers begin to experiment with the use of wire for fencing. And this makes sense, right? You use less wood and or depend on fewer post trees this way. Plus, despite the weight, metal wire travels rather well.
Yeah, wire is a pretty natural solution here. Wire fencing is less likely to be harmed by the weather. It doesn't get blown down by high winds because it doesn't have a flat side to catch the gales. It doesn't get weighed down by snow in the winter. It doesn't catch fire if it gets struck by lightning. Wire fencing is kind of a perfect solution for the plains.
Yeah, and it doesn't last forever, but it certainly stands the test of time. I mean, I feel like a lot of my childhood involved encountering old wire fences or barbed wire fences that no longer have any purpose. They're just there in the woods or, mm-hmm. And they're just – they have survived while everything else is just a ghost of whatever settlement it was a part of.
It was one of my favorite kinds of things to discover as a kid. Mm-hmm. I'd roam through the woods and you'd find like a half-buried old barbed wire fence.
Yeah, it's like that, maybe a sunken grave, and of course, like a line of buttercups that still come up marking some walkway to a lost house of some sort.
But there is a downside to wire fences, which is that they're not super strong, especially if, they might be strong for a human to try to get through. But imagine you are a bull.
Yes.
Or a bison.
Yeah, large animals like this, a cow, a bison, a horse, they can simply tear into it, make a mess of it, maybe get tangled up in it. But and the fence itself would be reduced to shambles and would no longer serve its purpose. And of course, if you were at all concerned about humans, a wire fence like this is not going to really be, any kind of an obstacle for humans either.
Mm-hmm.
So they quickly realized what was lacking here: spikes.
Right, passive weapons, just some static pokers to sit there and hurt you if you press too hard. So an American farmer and businessman named Joseph Glidden is often given credit for the invention of barbed wire, and he does play a very important role in the history of barbed wire, but it looks like there were a number of inventions of similar types of fencing material before Glidden swooped in. So we really need to take a pretty large step back before we get to Glidden, so we will get to him in a bit. One of the first things I thought we should mention, since we're still sort of in the what came before phase, is the idea of live fencing or live fence, specifically a species of plant known as Maclura palmifera, commonly known as the Osage orange or the hedge apple tree. You ever seen a hedge apple?
Oh, yeah, yeah. They're fun to kick down the road.
Yeah. Never tried to eat one. I wonder what they taste like.
I don't know. I never tried either.
I bet they're nasty. This was a thorny hedge plant that could be and was used as a kind of natural barbed wire to form boundaries and barriers, but it had many problems. You could try to line your fields with Osage orange, but it was difficult to maintain. It required a lot of trimming, like it can, shoot out big branches all over the place. And it, in Krell's words, quote, harbored noxious weeds.
Mm.
So the question is, can you recreate some of the desirable qualities of this thorn hedge through industrial means or synthetic means? And despite the historical association between barbed wire and the American ranchland frontier, it seems that a number of French inventors preceded the Americans. There were at least two French patents on barbed wire that came before any patents in America, and then another one that came before most patents in America. So let's look at France for a second.
Right. Now I will point out, though, that Krell doesn't seem to think that there's necessarily any connection between the French and the American inventions. They seem
right
to have come up with these independently. So I imagine it's one of those things you can ultimately explain just in terms of the material science reaching a point where people could innovate with it.
Or the demand.
Yeah.
Or there'd be a situation where this suddenly appears useful.
Right. And what's fascinating here is that the way that it's useful varies pretty greatly from Europe to the Americas.
That's right. So in the year 1860, there was a Frenchman named Léonce Eugène Gracin Badillon who acquired a patent for, quote, grating of wirework for fences and other purposes. And I've got an illustration for you to look at here, Robert. But this consisted of, quote, a system of twisted iron employing a flat, thin wire known commercially as ribbon iron that could be applied to everything that ought to be enclosed or fenced. And this Krell says this would include railing for parks, railroads, meadows, gardens, pavilions, and even trees. Like, God, imagine that world, you know, just a barbed wire fence for every tree.
If it's not clear already, the focus here is not so much on wandering cattle, but on people.
Yes. And Krell says that most historians have kind of ignored Gracin Badillon, but his patent was the first to describe the common features of twisted wire with sharp projections. Gracin Badillon called these projections bristling points. And Krell is careful to point out that GB here didn't describe the material as something that you would make fencing out of, but rather as something that would be mounted on top of a normal fence to make it harder to climb over.
Which is exactly how we see barbed wire used, and of course its cousin razor wire used today. Something you can put at the very top of a non-barbed fence, like, you know, cyclone fencing, etc., to make it difficult to climb over.
Right. So you want to put fencing around all the trees in your city or something. You put this on top of the fence around all the trees. Beautiful. But after this, there were more Frenchmen to follow with ideas for barbed wire. There was another guy named Louis-François Jeannin, who was awarded a patent in April 1865, so 5 years later, was awarded a patent for barbed wire of a kind of different design. Here, the fence would consist of double twisted wire with diamond-shaped barbs made out of flat pieces of sheet metal. So this isn't going to be little like pokers sticking out like thorns. This is going to be more like sharp, flat pieces of metal embedded in the wire as it goes along. Sort of little diamond-shaped blades.
Yeah. Well, one of the really interesting things to come out of researching this episode was just how many different types of barbed wire have been devised over
hundreds.
The years. Yeah, it's amazing. And we'll get more into some of the variety as we go here.
I mean, I think there were hundreds just between like 1867 and 1874 or so.
Yeah.
So a later patent was filed by a brick manufacturer from Brittany, and not to be confusing, if you don't know, Brittany is in Western France. It's not in Britain. Brittany in Western France, and this guy was named Gilbert Gavillard. This was granted in August 1867, and it was for Gavillard's Brevet d'Invention, which describes a fence composed of Ronces, my French is failing me here. Ronces artificielles, meaning artificial thorns. It would be things that would be, quote, caught between three strands of intertwined wire.
This brings to mind a description that Krell shares. He discusses the powerful Washburn and Moen Manufacturing Company out of Massachusetts, which was a major producer mm-hmm. of barbed wire, and of course a major marketer of barbed wire. They put out some gloriously over the top descriptions of barbed wire, the perfect fence. Mm-hmm. And one of the quotes from The Perfect Fence is, quote, "The steel barb is nothing more than a thorn, the spur the animal instantly retreats from and thereafter carefully avoids."
Yeah, it is compared to a thorn again and again. Emphasis on the natural the naturalness of the thorn. Mm-hmm. Michael Kelly of New York, who received a patent for a barbed wire design on February 11th, 1868, writes of his invention, quote, "My invention relates to imparting to fences of wire a character approximating to that of a thorn hedge. I prefer to designate the fence so produced as a thorny fence."
And, you know, you read these arguments and what could be more natural? You're not making something grossly artificial and industrial. No, you're taking something that the world does naturally, that vegetation does naturally,
uh-huh.
and just applying it a little more towards your specific aim.
Well, yeah. Yeah, I wonder if Gressin Bedelon was anticipating somebody like me who's horrified by the idea of a barbed wire fence around every tree, because when he's talking about his proposal for tree guards, he writes that they, quote, maybe of double ribbon wire, which allows the addition of small wire points, and when these ribbons are twisted together, the wire points bristle in every direction and form spikes imitating thorn branches. He's just saying it's like another part of the tree. It's just like a plant.
Yeah. You can well imagine him today saying, naturally, trees grow upward and reach towards the heavens. Why not also help transmit wireless signals for our telephones? What could be more natural?
Uh-huh. But it's funny. I mean, and we're not even really brushing the surface of all the different marketing materials and patents and advertisements and everything that described barbed wire as a thorn.
Right.
They were obsessed with this idea that it's just like a thorn bush. It's just like a briar. And I wonder if – and I wonder where a lot of these comparisons are coming from. I think some of it – must be coming from like trying to make it seem more humane, more natural, less like some kind of gross metal claw that's invading your environment.
Right. And then some of the literature too is really just pressing just how cultured it is, how essential it is to have fencing. Mm-hmm. That fencing is the thing that separates us from the savages,
right?
Which, you know, as Krell points out, is just, you know, steeped in the language of European colonists.
Yes, and Krell also shows these advertisements from the time that sort of envision barbed wire as the demarcation line of a kind of controlled Arcadia, where he would depict people walking along lanes where they would be surrounded by beautiful plants and then also just like menageries of animals all mixed together, like elephants and camels and horses and dogs and stuff all in the same pens. But they're all separated from these lanes by this elegant looking barbed wire.
Yeah.
And so it's like I don't know. It enforces this theme of like man versus beast and humankind versus nature, and we can tame it and put it in the box and control it with these artificial – with these industrial thorns, these thorns of human ingenuity.
Yeah, there's one point where Krell is dealing with this this illustration by one of the barbed wire masters there of a cow trying to eat an apple, mm-hmm. but is prevented from reaching that apple in this a pristine garden environment by barbed wire fencing,
uh-huh.
which he compares then to the Garden of Eden and the tree of knowledge of good and evil and so forth, which is maybe a bit of a stretch, but still I like the argument.
If we just had one of those tree guards in the garden, there wouldn't have been a fall.
Right. Yeah. The fence is order, and the opposite of order is chaos.
Right. So maybe we should take a quick break, and then when we come back, we can explore the year that the dam broke on the barbed wire flood.
I'm Hannah Storm, and my podcast, NBA DNA with Hannah Storm, digs deep into the history of professional basketball, along with my own as one of the first female sportscasters.
Now let's get you up to speed on what else happened around the NBA today.
We talked to all sorts of people I interacted with, from Dr. J to Charles Barkley, and recap iconic moments.
Yes, he's got it. Here he comes. Ray rocked the baby to sleep and slam dunk.
As well as some of the wild stories behind the scenes.
We were like, what? What are we in for? The scoreboard crashes before we even tip a game off.
Today, the NBA is a global sports and entertainment giant. Players are multimillionaires and cultural icons.
Iguodala to Curry, back to Iguodala, up for the layup. Oh, blocked by James!
And these stories are about how we got here, both on and off the court. And what's next? Listen to NBA DNA with Hannah Storr on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
When your child fights sleep, it can feel like a battle you'll never win. Imagine a bedtime routine you all look forward to, where you cuddle in and let the stress of the day melt away. Welcome to Sleep Tight Stories, a calming weekly podcast that brings bedtime stories, cuddles, and comfort to families worldwide.
The stories are quirky, relatable, and spark wonder without overstimulation, so listeners can fall asleep and stay asleep. Each episode is narrated by me, Cheryl McLeod, a second grade teacher, and written by my husband, Clark, an eternal second grader at heart. Tune in tonight and bond over a story before drifting off to sleep. Make bedtime the sweetest part of your day. Sleep tight stories. Listen to Sleep Tight Stories on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Parents, ready to discover a new educational and interactive podcast for kids? Join Stories for Kids by Lingo Kids, where episodes are packed with fun activities. Right, Elliot?
Oh, yes! We learned how to recycle at the beach.
That was great fun. Callie, what do you say?
It was. And that time when we did the science experiment and Billy made raisins dance.
That is so cool, Billy.
He did. Not to mention when a certain Elliot took up swimming classes with Lisa.
That was me.
Bet you can't catch me.
I'm going to get you.
All this fun and more in our Stories for Kids. Lingo Kids Stories for Kids is now available on Storybun, the kid-friendly device for screenless podcast listening. Listen to Stories for Kids on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, we're back. So as we mentioned earlier, you had the Homestead Act of 1862 that really opened up the Great American Desert. And it's in the wake of this that we begin to see this real rush, right?
Right. It seems that something happened around the year 1867, because that's the year that a ton of barbed wire patents began popping up in the United States. We mentioned that the first patent was in France in 1860. There was another one in 1865. And then in 1867, the American floodgates open. There were so many barbed wire patents and designs that popped up between around 1867 and running into the mid-1870s. And again, we mentioned earlier some of the demands that might have put pressure on this invention. You've got the continued colonization of the Western prairie lands, the desire for farmers to keep animals in and or keep animals out of their fields in a place where lumber was scarce and the weather could easily damage a solid wooden fence anyway. Wire fencing was kind of this perfect solution. And then the barbs, meanwhile, were there to discourage animals from knocking down the wire fencing. So who were some of these early American inventors of the industrial thorn? There are honestly too many to name here, but just to mention a few, there was a guy named Alfonso Dabb of Elizabethport, New Jersey. And he got a patent in April 1867 for an improvement in pickets for fences and walls. And this would be like you've got a wrought iron mounting strip, and you could put this on top of an existing fence or an existing wall. And this would be to, in Dabb's words, quote, stop juveniles or others from climbing them.
Yeah. So these are anti-human spikes that
yes.
you would put on top of a fence. And you attached a picture of this for our notes here. And really, they look more like spearheads or bayonets or something to that effect.
Yes.
Less like anything we would identify as barbed wire.
Yeah, these are less for agriculture. These are something that would go on top of an existing fence, and they would poke your butt if you tried to climb over. And then in the same year, but a few months later, in June 1867, a Lucien B. Smith of Kent, Ohio, came up with a barbed wire invention, which Smith describes thusly, quote, posts of cast iron between which two or more stout wires are strung tightly, which wires are provided with spools a few feet apart and protected with short projecting points. And this is so, quote, a fence of this kind can be constructed very cheaply and will turn animals readily as they can see it better than the ordinary wire fence, which has nothing attached to the wires to attract attention, and the animals will not counter the spurs or the spools. So this is kind of interesting. Mm-hmm. Smith is saying not only will these spurs poke the animals if they press against the fence and deter them there, it'll also make the fence more visible to the animals so that they won't need to poke up against it, brush against it by accident. They'll be able to see it more easily than they would see just plain smooth wire. And another early American patent for something counting as a barbed wire fence belonged to an inventor named William D. Hunt of New York. This was awarded in July 1867. The design here is a little bit different from the barbed wire we're familiar with. It was conceived as a farming and ranching innovation, and from Hunt's patent, he describes it as, quote, "The spurs fit the wire loosely so as to revolve easily upon it. By providing the wire with these sharp spur wheels, animals are deterred from pushing against the fence or attempting to break over it." And so this would not be twisted wire forming little artificial thorns, but rather it would be a smooth wire along which are strung like beads, these little kind of like saw blade looking things that can rotate freely around the wire. And then they would be held basically in place by little studs on the wire.
Yeah, kind of like little ninja throwing stars, right?
Yes.
And, you know, this one also, this one looks kind of neat, actually, the illustration. And I can imagine it being kind of, you know, shiny and decorative, if it was deployed in a way that would, you know, perhaps be pleasing to the eyes, but also coming back to that previous point, perhaps highly visible to animals.
Yeah, and I think this might actually be a slightly more humane version of barbed wire. I'm not sure because I haven't tried it myself, but it would still provide a painful resistance if, say, cows tried to press up against it. But because the sharp spur rotates freely around the wire, it seems a lot less likely than the barbed wire we're used to catch and tear skin. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Like, it's not a hook going into you. It's just a sharp little thing. And the fact that it rotates means it, you know, it might hurt to press against it, but it's not going to stay in you. Now, there's a great thing that's quoted in Krell's book, which is Hunt describing his inspiration for the invention, which was basically he had had trouble with a very stubborn mule. And he said, quote, "I made up my mind that one young mule couldn't beat me, so one day the idea suggested itself to me. Somehow, I don't know as I can tell how, that a wire fence might be burred, as I called it then, barbed, as it has been changed to since, and I thought it would make a good thing. The reason why I thought so was that this mule would press against a thing and stand so obstinate it would hang against the board of a fence, and I thought if I had something sharp, he wouldn't crowd it so hard."
So, bird fencing, colon, a good thing.
Well, at least to Hunt it was, you know, when you got a stubborn mule. But there are many problems with the early designs for barbed wire fencing. A lot of these designs beginning in 1867 might have been effective if they were used, but there were problems with the production. The barbs had to be created and placed along the wire by hand, and this was extremely laborious, potentially dangerous or painful for the worker. It would have made production of the wire slow and expensive.
Yeah, because you're basically having to make a necklace every time you string up some wire.
Yeah.
If you're having to, you know, beat it with these little shurikens and so forth.
Right. So the next major revolution in barbed wire, I think, was less about how effective the specific wire design was at controlling animals, and more about how the design could be mass produced. And this is where Joseph Glidden comes in. This is where everything seems to change. In the year 1874, Joseph Glidden patented the first design for barbed wire that would ever become a huge commercial success. According to Krell, in 1874, just about 10,000 pounds of barbed wire were produced and sold. 6 years later, in 1880, that figure was more than 80 million pounds.
There's a great line from Glidden's marketing. He claimed that his wire was, quote, "lighter than air, stronger than whiskey, cheaper than dust."
Well, that taps into another thing that I think is common in barbed wire marketing, which is, I think, pretty straightforward appeals to kind of masculinity marketing. Mm-hmm. There's like very gendered marketing with barbed wire. You know what I mean?
Well, I mean, it was pretty obvious that it was going to be a male audience that was going to be buying this barbed wire for a variety of reasons. But yeah, there's this whole, again, the man versus nature, a taming of the wilderness. For the most part, but we will get into a major divide on that as we move forward.
Sure. So what was Glidden's mass production method? Well, it involved taking two strands of wire and twisting them around each other while barbs were automatically strung along one of the two wires and then held in place by the wrapping of the second wire. It's a pretty ingenious method.
Yeah, it's basically an example of what we come to see as the standard in barbed wire, and that is the sense of barbed wire as a kind of knot that is formed, as opposed to something that is manufactured by the beating of spikes and so forth.
Exactly, yeah. Now, there was a huge amount of legal battling over barbed wire patents, but Glidden managed to come out ahead in all of this with his mass production method. His barbed wire knot was also pretty straightforward.
By the way, about the legal battle, there is a whole history here with this sort of battle royale of all these various American individuals.
We'll get into that in a minute.
Yeah. I was running across articles in the New York Times from the day where they had updates to the legal battle.
Yeah, it was a crazy drama, and we'll even get to some poetry about that drama in a minute. Now, there's another interesting fact here, which is that there are some versions of the story that point out Joseph Glidden's wife, Lucinda Warren Glidden's role in this. Apparently, Lucinda helped Joseph figure out the process that would set his barbed wire apart. So first, Glidden used his wife's hairpins to twist sharp points that he tried to attach to a piece of straight wire. But like many other barbed wire inventors before him, he came across a problem, which was that the hairpin barbs kept slipping down the length of the wire. They couldn't be held in place. So to describe what happened next, I'm going to quote from Krell, quote, "Turning next to a coffee mill retrieved from their kitchen, Glidden converted it in such a way that by cranking it, he could produce a uniform barb. The problem of the sliding barbs was finally resolved when he hit upon the idea that a second wire might secure them if it were twisted around the first. To this end, he converted an old grindstone into a rudimentary twisting device and, with the help of Lucinda, who turned the grindstone while he held the wire, proceeded to make the first 66 feet of barbed wire in their backyard."
Also, thank you, husband, for turning every device in our house into a barbed wire construction method.
Yeah. From then on, the coffee tastes like barbed wire.
Yeah. Now, another interesting individual in all this was John Warren Bet-A-Million Gates.
Oh, boy.
So named because it said that he'd take bets on whether cows could break through his wire.
Uh-huh.
And apparently there was some this criticism that he was maybe using really lazy cows or, I was reading some sort of back and forth on this. But either way, he became quite rich off the product, though he engaged apparently at times in the sale of, quote, moonshine wire. Which, if I'm understanding correctly, would have been like kind of like bootleg design wires, barbed wire recipes that he wasn't actually, legally supposed to be selling.
The amount of anguish over bootleg or like scalped barbed wire is one of the most shocking things I discovered in this. There was great passion about the intellectual property disputes of barbed wire in the 1870s and 80s. And this is because Glidden was not the only person to invent a barbed wire in the 1870s or to invent an effective mass production system for barbed wire. There was another inventor named Jacob Haish who came up with a similar process to Glidden's in the same year, but Glidden won the legal battle over precedence. In fact, there were at least three inventors. So you had Glidden, you had Jacob Haish, and then there was a hardware dealer named Isaac L. Elwood, who were all involved in a long-running IP dispute after they each tried to file patents for barbed wire after the three of them all visited the DeKalb, Illinois County Fair of 1873, where the three of them all saw a display by a guy named Henry Rose, which included a long strip of wood that had barbs attached to it, which could be used to keep an animal from pressing against a fence. Mm. And so all three of them looked at this idea of Rose's, so like a long wooden dowel with barbs on it, all three of them independently had the idea that it would make more sense to do the same thing but put the barbs on a length of wire instead of a wooden rod, and then all three set to work trying to acquire a patent, and Glidden just happened to turn out the big winner of this long and acrimonious dispute. But I think it's funny that like they're fighting each other, and like they all basically got the idea from this other guy.
Yeah.
But they just all had the insight that wire would work better than a wooden rod. But at some point, the defeated inventor, Jacob Haish, who lost this intellectual property battle to Joseph Glidden, he wrote a poem called "Be as Happy as You Can" that is quoted in Krell's book. This is so good. This life is not all sunshine, as barb fence scalpers have found. The crosses they bear are heavy, and under them lies no crown. And while they're seeking the roses, the thorns full oft they scan. Yet let them, though they're wounded, be as happy as they can. It's like the Bobby Fuller Four's letter dance of barbed wire.
And in this, we do have the crown of Christ imagery as well.
Absolutely. But what comes out of this is that Glidden's version of barbed wire is probably correctly understood to be the progenitor of most existing types of barbed wire today.
Yeah. In summary, via Krell, it is accurate to say that barbed wire, quote, was born in France, independently conceived in the eastern states of America, New Jersey, Ohio, and New York, and grew up on the prairies and plains where, for different reasons, farmers especially and later ranchers turned increasingly to fencing. All right, we're going to take a break, but when we come back, we will continue to discuss barbed wire, and we'll even get into one or two examples of barbed wire used in a way that we might well describe as, I don't know.
Not evil.
Yeah, yeah, I think that would be accurate.
I'm Hannah Storm, and my podcast, NBA DNA with Hannah Storm, digs deep into the history of professional basketball, along with my own as one of the first female sportscasters.
Now let's get you up to speed on what else happened around the NBA today.
We talked to all sorts of people I interacted with, from Dr. J to Charles Barkley, and recap iconic moments.
Yes, he's got it. Here he comes. Ray rock the baby to sleep and slam dunk.
As well as some of the wild stories behind the scenes.
We were like, what? What are we in for? The scoreboard crashes before we even tip a game off.
Today, the NBA is a global sports and entertainment giant. Players are multimillionaires and cultural icons.
Iguodala to Curry, back to Iguodala, up for the layup. Oh, blocked by James! LeBron James!
And these stories are about how we got here, both on and off the court. And what's next? Listen to NBA DNA with Hannah Storm on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Parents, ready to discover a new educational and interactive podcast for kids? Join Stories for Kids by Lingo Kids, where episodes are packed with fun activities. Right, Elliot?
Oh, yes! We learned how to recycle at the beach.
That was great fun. Callie, what do you say?
It was. And that time when we did the science experiment and Billy made raisins dance.
That is so cool, Billy.
He did. Not to mention when a certain Elliot took up swimming classes with Lisa.
That was me.
Bet you can't catch me.
I'm going to get you.
All this fun and more in our Stories for Kids. Lingo Kids Stories for Kids is now available on Storybutton, the kid-friendly device for screenless podcast listening. Listen to Stories for Kids on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
Western nations like the U.S. and Europe.
Mexico will likely have its first female president.
And then you have China.
And help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters.
He'll get his yo-yos to Europe in time. But the longer this drags on, the more worry he's getting.
They knew that they needed to do this as fast as they possibly could to get a drug on the market as fast as they could.
I'm David Gura.
I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen. We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets.
Basically, everyone was expecting, if not a calamity, certainly a recession.
But the problem is that that paperwork, as our reporting showed, is fake.
As someone who's covering the market, I'm often very worried about an imminent collapse. So I'm thinking about it quite often.
Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, we're back. So there are, again, many different varieties of barbed wire, and one book that is often mentioned in writings about the history of barbed wire is a book that was published in 1977 titled The Barbed Wire Bible, that's Bobbed, B-O-B-B-E-D, by Jack Glover, published in 77, and I think earlier as well. I think maybe the edition I was looking at was from 77. And it contains illustrations of 734 different steel barbed wire knots, including things like Scutt's wooden block and the Shin Round Line lock barb. If you can find a copy of this or just find some images of pages from this book, it's pretty fascinating because they're neat little illustrations, and it just really drives home the diversity that went into envisioning all the ways that you could create a barb out of metal wiring.
It's amazing how much human imagination went into lengths of wire that can hurt you.
Yeah. Now, a particularly nasty variation on all this is we mentioned razor wire briefly earlier, or concertina wire, which is either the same or very similar depending on how specific you get in your barbed wire terminology.
I thought concertina wire had to do with like how it was coiled.
Yeah. But sometimes the words are – sometimes people say Constantine wire, which is just a perversion of the term.
Oh, okay.
But in these, we're really getting into anti-human barbed wire varieties that you usually see used in military, penal, or border settings.
Mm-hmm.
The development and widespread use of this sort of wire really goes back to the First and Second World Wars, where they were used in trench warfare environments and other fortifications.
Yeah, and this does seem to be a change over time, that like early on, most of the messaging about barbed wire is, as Krell points out, this culture versus nature thing. It's humankind versus the untamed animal world, and you're putting these barriers in place to keep the animals in or keep the animals out. Especially over the course of the 20th century, barbed wire it takes a much darker turn, and we see it more and more deployed specifically for uses on humans, to keep the humans in or to keep the humans out.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, we mentioned earlier about like masculinity and the marketing and acceptance of barbed wire. One huge fact of the American West was that while farmers were very much in favor of barbed wire, cattlemen were not. Because what does it do when you start throwing up miles and miles of barbed wire fencing? Well, it disrupts the open grazing lands, it prevents cattle and horses from moving around freely, or prevents cowboys from moving a herd across great distances. And on top of that, cattle and horses could get pretty messed up in barbed wire. I mean, that's one thing that is often kind of skimmed over in the marketing material this stuff can really cut up an animal and or a human and put them in some pretty put them in dire shape.
Well, I think that specifically a lot of the early advertising was trying to be misleading. That's why it kept emphasizing the thorn thing.
Yeah.
I think it was trying to suggest your animals will not get hurt. You know,
right.
they will just it will just deter them.
Yeah, it's just we're just strategically deploying something that they would otherwise encounter naturally.
Yeah.
But that's not really quite the case. So cattlemen did not really take kindly to barbed wire for a very long time. It was also apparently decried by Texans as not only cruel and alien to the culture of the open range, but also, as Krell points out, quote, a Yankee scheme to benefit the industrial North.
Okay.
Which, I don't know. I mean, you can certainly understand that point of view, right? Because look at some of the places it's coming from. So some of the birthplaces of the barbed wire industry.
Mm-hmm.
You could easily see it's like, well, this is some stuff that's made up north and they're bringing it down here and they're just selling it to all these farmers and it's just cutting up our land. And so this is like a whole part of Wild West history, I guess wasn't that familiar with. But cattlemen would sometimes get fed up with it and they'd go and they just cut down like miles of barbed wire fencing, sometimes as part of masked gangs working at night. And these masked gangs sometimes even had cool gang titles. And then at first it was illegal fencing, but then they would also use these vigilante powers against legal fencing as well.
Mm-hmm.
And in terms of just sort of the humane or inhumane aspect of barbed wire, you had varieties of more humane barbed wire designs that were rolled out, the idea being that it would be easier for cattle to be freed from them. One variety I was looking at in particular had blocks of wood that were inset in the wire as well. But this ended up not really taking off, and I imagine a big part of it is that it's just more manufacturing required,
mm-hmm.
Either on the industrial end or on the farmer's end, and therefore it just wasn't it wasn't picked up. Easier to stick with the crueler product in this case. Also, Krell points out that the use of barbed wire against humans and animals led to a micro-industry of barbed wire liniments and antiseptics, such as silver pine healing oil or Dr. Cox liniments and antiseptic, among others. Basically, like, you know, kind of snake oil-esque ointments. They may have done some good.
Put the healing power of Dr. Cox's on your barbed wire.
Yeah,
but your animals will be healthy as ever.
Exactly. But I mean, it really shows you, like, there were enough people and animals getting cut up by this stuff that there was a side industry of selling specialized ointments to deal with all of those cuts to humans and livestock.
Yeah, totally. And as long as we're talking about the cultural impact, I mean, obviously, barbed wire, I think, came to be seen as one of the most iconic technologies symbolizing the brutal conquest of the North American continent from the native peoples who lived there.
Yeah, yeah, this is where apparently the name the Devil's Rope comes from. That was one of the names for it that was used by the native peoples of North America.
Some of the Plains tribes called it Devil's Rope, yeah.
Yeah, and speaking, too, of the pre-colonial West, it was not only humans and domestic herds that were impacted, but also the American bison, which, of course, more famously suffered from overhunting, hunted to the brink of extinction. But also this ever-expanding use of barbed wire also cut them off from vital grazing and watering areas.
Mm-hmm. So while the story of the invention of barbed wire is an interesting one, it's hard not to be left I don't know, when you just think about the impact of this technology, left with a pretty depressing landscape.
Yeah, yeah. It does literally make a landscape look depressing, at least the more you think about it. It's like, again, barbed wire is something, especially if you've grown up around it, you can take it for granted, especially if it is not used so much against you, if it's used against livestock or against, people in an outlying group that you are not a part of. Perhaps you can be blind to its impact as well. But for the most part, it's not an invention that I would really classify in the good category. However, there are a couple of examples of uses for barbed wire, both of which surprised me. The first of which is that while barbed wire couldn't transmit a signal as well as traditional telephone wire, which is insulated copper wiring, you still saw this case in the early 1930s, where rural farmers were some of the early adopters of this new technology of telephone lines.
Mm-hmm.
And for a few years, they were actually using barbed wire because they had to build out their own telephone collectives. And without easy access to all that insulated copper wire, they had access to the barbed wire. They just string the barbed wire instead. Which is interesting.
Wonder what this call sounded like.
Well, probably pretty rough. Probably just clear enough to get by. This was like just a few years before then it was replaced. And also at that point, the farmers were no longer required to string their own wiring. Now, a more surprising use, multiple cases I came across of in which barbed wire has been used for science. So you have a great many studies that utilize strands of barbed wire. Usually it's like a single strand to study bear populations. So basically what you have is a situation where researchers will use single strands of barbed wire to obtain fur samples from wild bear populations for DNA testing. And this also entails baiting them a little bit, which according to Tom Dixon of Montana Outdoors, this would be a bottle that contains, quote, a year old fermented mix of cow blood and fish guts, which to a human is pretty disgusting, but to a bear, mwah,
nice,
worth checking out. So, this is fascinating. So the idea, of course, is not to hurt the bear and really not even necessarily to like scrape into its skin, but to catch some of its fur, this ample, fur armor that like a black bear has on its body.
Mm-hmm.
So the bear will come to check out the bait. And when it does so, the barbs on the barbed wire will catch some of the fur and pull it free. And then researchers are able to use that fur and look at the DNA and use it to understand, basically the shape of wild bear populations. So we can at least we can put that then another check under the positive uses of barbed wire in world history, a way of caring for bear populations.
I like it.
Yeah. But that's all I have. Sorry. It's just those two. That's those are the only examples.
It's also fun to play with.
Is it? Barbed wire?
Kind of. I don't know. When I was a kid, it
were you
like
a backyard wrestler?
No.
What were you playing with?
No. Not for its – I don't know. It was just like kind of cool to like whip around and stuff.
Oh, well, I guess.
I don't know. It's fun to play with in the same way that like a good stick's fun to play with.
Well, you know, I don't – here's the thing. I do remember like kids – When I was a kid in Newfoundland, Canada, the other kids, the older kids, the dangerous kids were into two things. Michael Jackson, those red leather jackets, you know, like Michael Jackson
what,
wore.
Really?
Yeah, those were okay. Very popular. And then everybody was making they were making like a mace out of a stick of wood that had nails driven through it.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, they're just it was like Lord of the Flies, I guess.
This sounds like an 80s movie.
Yeah, it was. This was the 80s.
Were they on rollerblades?
No, because the roads were all gravel where I was. I don't know what you would have done with a rollerblade there. But I don't remember there being a lot of barbed wire around. If there had been, I'm sure they would have wrapped it around their makeshift melee weapons.
Did they answer to Lord Humongous?
I'm sure they knew Lord Humongous. I think he was pretty popular at the time. But yeah, I think that would have been the window for me encountering people playing with barbed wire. For the most part, I think I was always like a little wary of it because when I would encounter barbed wire, there was a very good chance it was either like super rusty and therefore kind of icky, or it might be electrified and therefore I really don't want to touch it.
Hmm.
Of course, that's another feature we didn't even mention about barbed wire is that if strung properly, then you can put an electric current through it, which adds to its effectiveness.
Yeah, and I think in some cases use it like especially in ranching or you know livestock control whatever places where you would once have barbed wire have been replaced mostly with electric fencing.
Yeah, because if you have an electric current going through it, you need not have actual barbs because you have electric barbs. But I will come back to what I said earlier is that I think that our attitudes toward barbed wire, you know, they're going to really revolve around our own experience and like the area in which we encountered it. So I'd love to hear from listeners out there, like how do you interact with barbed wire? Like what comes to mind when you think of barbed wire? And to what extent is it influenced by the way it is used in your rural setting, in your urban setting, as it's used in, say, you know, prison environments or, you know, border environments or used in warfare, fortifications, et cetera. I'd love to hear from everybody on these points. In the meantime, if you want to check out other episodes of Invention, including that episode that we did on walls, for example, you can head on over to inventionpod.com. That'll shoot you over to the iHeart listing for this show. But you can find us absolutely anywhere, wherever you get your podcast and wherever that happens to be. Just rate, review, and subscribe. Those are some acts you can do that really help us out. Also, tell a friend. If you enjoy Invention, tell another human being about the show, and perhaps they'll enjoy it as well. And I'm suddenly remembering we didn't even get into tattoos. How many tattoos of barbed wire are there? And then I wonder, are people really appreciating all the varieties of barbed wire? If you're thinking of getting a barbed wire tattoo,
what?
Stop and go get that book that I mentioned earlier with the 700 and something different varieties of barbed wire.
Mm.
And just look around a little bit. Do a little shopping, a little window shopping before you decide on a particular brand of barbed wire that is going to be tattooed around your bicep.
Get one of the French varieties.
Yeah.
Huge thanks, as always, to our excellent audio producer, Seth Nicholas Johnson. If you would like to get in touch with us with feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hello, you can email us at contact@inventionpod.com.
Invention is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
I'm Johnny B. Goode, the host of the podcast Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon. This podcast dives deep into the story of Ray Trapani and his company, Centratech. I'll explore how 320-somethings built a company out of lies, deceit, and greed,
I've been saying since a very young age that I was going to be a millionaire. If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
Listen to Creating a Con, the story of Bitcoin, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Every family has an origin story, one passed down through the generations. Mine happens to be a mystery involving my great-great-grandmother left behind in Sicily. I'm Joe Piazza, and my new podcast will transport you to the gorgeous island of Sicily as I trace my roots back through a whodunit for the ages. Listen to The Sicilian Inheritance on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Discover a new educational and interactive podcast, Stories for Kids by Lingo Kids. Our episodes are packed with fun activities. Right, Elliot?
Oh, yes! We went shape hunting around the block, and we found spheres and cubes on the street.
That was great fun. Join Stories for Kids, the Lingo Kids podcast, inspiring you to learn while having fun. Listen to Stories for Kids on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.